The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Leigh Alexander, and what's going to be our last edition of the year before the tech team take a well-deserved break and we'll start back again in January. This week, we thought we'd pin our tech colors to the mast and bring you the top moments in tech this year. For this monumental task, I'm joined by basically everybody. Can we go around the table?
Jemima Kish, chief minstrel eater, I think, today.
Yeah, that looks to be. Congratulations.
Keith Stewart, chief games player.
Sam Gibbs, chief wearable addict.
You're not even wearing one wearable. Yeah. Oh, there it is.
I came in this morning wearing six.
Stealth wearable.
Jesus. Alana Crassi, chief tweeter.
Alex Hearn, deputy tweeter.
And Bitcoin's expert. Jemima, do you want to do the Christmas crackers now?
I feel like we should wait till the end, really.
I can wait till the end.
It's just I'm desperate for the jokes.
Well, you proposed that we do a star ranking system for the podcast today.
Yes.
Do you want to float some theories of how we're going to apply the star rankings?
Well, we were thinking of ways of sort of ranking our favourite moments of the year and perhaps a sort of star rating out of five for the excitement.
How excited we are about the moment.
Or how excited we were at the time and how excited and I suppose...
Can we do a mince pie rating instead?
Yeah, well, all right then.
Well, we only have three left.
They're not puff pastry.
No. So we've decided actually to do our list really in no particular order because we're not hierarchical here. You know, we're all very liberal. So or maybe just because we couldn't agree on what should be first. But one of the things we were sort of debating this even being a tech issue, but we decided to do it anyway because we thought it was relevant and we can craft a technology tie-in out of almost any topic if we want to. So podcasts.
Leading the charge.
Yeah, leading the charge.
They're big this year, aren't they, podcasts?
Well, I mean, we say that, but they are. And, you know, I know that all my friends listened to podcasts and they weren't really for me up till now. But I think there's a new level of ubiquity for the podcast culture on mobile devices. Lena, you're looking at me with an expression of extreme disdain and skepticism.
Because I don't listen to podcasts. I know this is a really bad thing to say on a podcast. I'm really sorry. Obviously, I listen to Tech Weekly every week.
Do you listen to the ones that you're on?
I'm only on one, so yes. I think what maybe one day... I mean, I haven't even tried listening to Serial, so...
What?
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm a terrible person, etc.
Don't you think like podcasts are ultimate commuter fodder? I mean, you stick them in your ears and then you try and ignore the person sitting directly opposite you on the train.
But I'm busy listening to Taylor Swift. Why would I listen to a podcast when I can listen to Taylor Swift's excellent album?
Okay, again, audio. I think audio has quite unfairly been overlooked for a couple of years now because there's been so much interest and so much growth around video and it makes so much money for advertisers and because it's really visual and engaging, that's what advertisers have loved. But what you get with audio as a creative medium is something much more intimate and where you feel a real sort of affinity for the voice of the person you're listening to, and it kind of prods your imagination to visualize the things you're listening to in a really powerful way that you just don't get with video.
Now you're making me want to listen to podcasts.
Well, this is the thing about Serial, is you start to, you're introduced slowly to all of the characters and you, the presenter, Sarah Koenig, has a really lovely warmth and sort of naturalness to her voice and the way she presents the ideas, and you just get sucked into the really compelling story.
What I find quite interesting is that in terms of the actual hard figures, everything I've seen suggests that podcasting hasn't reached some watershed moment this year, that actually what's happened over the last decade, really, since it began, is that there's been a steady growth in it, that podcasting has been getting bigger. It's never really had slumps, but it's also never really had spurts.
On the tech side, do you think that has to do with the fact that tools for both listening and discoverability are more plentiful and diverse?
I think they have, likewise, they've been getting steadily more plentiful and diverse. So you know, right now there's a wealth of podcasting apps for smartphones, which weren't there 5 years ago. There's a wealth of hosting services, and of course, just more and more people now have a computer with GarageBand, something with a mic on it. It's simply more practical for the average person to record a podcast. But I really do think that what we're seeing isn't so much podcasts have suddenly taken off, as every 2 years or so they have that steady growth has meant that they are new to a new group of people.
There is also a bit of speculation that the growth of podcasts and the popularity of them in America in particular is because of driving and
Wi-Fi car radios.
So
better car radios, yeah.
Better in-car technology has meant that it's easier and more convenient to access a whole swathe of new stuff. I mean, I've been in cars that aren't that old, and actually you can still only get the traditional radio stations, which are very limited very quickly. So you can see the appeal there.
Sam, you had something to add.
One of the things I listen to podcasts for is time shifting. I mean, I do a lot of time shifting in video. I don't watch pretty much any broadcast television live, and I don't listen to radio live, but I do listen to the podcasts of radio programs because it's then at a time that suits me, i.e. my commute. And I mean, that kind of thing just seems totally logical for me, but I don't know why other people haven't latched onto it.
Keith, what about you?
I think something interesting has happened with podcasts, in that it seems to have gone through like a hyper accelerated version of television history, in that when television started, everyone got involved and everyone was excited about it because it was this amazing new technology. But they kind of consume the media in the same way they consume radio. And that's kind of what's happened with podcasts. Like, people used it in a very sort of radio-esque way, in a very personal way. But I think what Serial kind of hints towards is this idea that there can be event podcasting coming in, where people choose, where it becomes like a water cooler type thing. Whereas that's, podcasting has never done that before. But I think we're maybe entering into that era where it becomes, you know, the next Apprentice or
I think Serial is approaching that the way that you point out. If you go to Reddit, there are all these massive threads discussing the ins and outs of the Serial story. It's actually a bit uncomfortable when you remember that we're talking about an actual murder of somebody and you know, potential actual guilt or innocence issues that affect real people's lives. So yeah, it's interesting. I think that definitely is a conundrum to think about. How many stars does podcasting get, Jemima?
Oh, podcasting. How excited did we get this year? Well, you know, a bit, but not loads. Maybe two.
So out of five?
Out of five. Two,
okay.
Out of five.
Everybody hold up your fingers.
Because we've been excited about it before.
Yeah, we're having an average 2 out of 5. Sam, yeah. Sam votes 3. He's a little more excited about it.
I just think, you know, this is the year of podcasting, and 2013 was the year of podcasting before that, and 2012 was the year of... If you've got something that's steadily growing, every year is going to be the best year yet. And this year was the best year yet for podcasts.
Yay, 2 stars. There was a very big acquisition this year. It was the purchase of Oculus Rift by Facebook, which I think came out of left field for a lot of people and was a major, major shock. Who wants to start outlining some of the details of this deal? I think everyone's looking to Keith.
Yeah,
I don't
know.
No pressure, Keith.
Yeah, I think, that was really interesting, and people didn't see that coming. But I think in some ways, it was one of those deals where after it happened, everyone went, oh, of course, because obviously, you know, Facebook is reaching kind of saturation point with what it can do with a browser window where all your friends' kind of activities are shown on a wall. And what Oculus Rift offers, obviously, is an amazing new, possibly interactive, multiplayer telepresence medium, which Facebook could easily sort of key into and use. So I suspect what Mark Zuckerberg is thinking is, oh, you know, maybe in 5-10 years' time, what people will do, instead of leaving comments on each other's walls, will be, let's put a virtual reality headset on and meet my friends in some strange virtual reality location. Like, so instead of saying, oh, I went to Spain and here's my images of my children in their trunks, let's all meet up on the surface of Mars and have a chat. So, you know, I think that's what Mark Zuckerberg is.
That aspiration was worth about $2 billion to the company.
Yeah, just to be
quite
able
a big
to
acquisition.
Avoid.
Yeah. I think there was a bit of a developer kind of bromance here. I think he just loved the product. He loved the scene. He loved the fact that they were very, very skilled, really talented developers. And I think, you know, he was buying a lot of the talent and vision as much as the existing product.
I mean, it absolutely is a culture fit. Both companies, Facebook and Oculus, are sort of founded by these young wunderkinds who are really excited about the future. So I imagine that...
The Palmer Luckey story is
he made it in his garage.
It's pure. It's 100% concentrated Silicon Valley stuff. You read the venture capitalists who invested in Oculus before the Facebook buyer, and it's Palmer. You know, Palmer grew up wanting virtual reality, and when he was of the age to tinker in a garage, no one had told him it was impossible. So he just made it, and the Oculus was the result. And it's like it doesn't really factor into that. The first Oculus was
college as well.
Yeah, it doesn't.
They also had a round of Kickstarter backing to fund the initial prototype. So, I mean, if I had backed the early development on Kickstarter and now I don't get a portion of this massive sale, that's a, you know, interesting hazard of backing on crowdfunding platforms. But, you know, any sort of integration is still quite a bit down the line, isn't it, Keith?
Yeah, very much. I think what Facebook have said is they're going to leave it alone. They're going to leave Oculus alone to do their own thing. You know, Oculus have a thing. They've got 70,000 developers working on Oculus games. You know, DevKit 2 came out earlier this year and it's really, really impressive. So it'll be interesting to see what happens and whether how much they leave Oculus alone going forward. But at the moment, it's very much still a kind of games and applications platform.
Alex?
Oculus, I mean, it's also, you know, that safe cushion of Facebook's money is quite important, but it has led to the company being in a bit of an odd position right now. They just partnered with Samsung to bring out an entirely separate platform for virtual reality games. And now it's one of those things which, if Oculus were a typical hardware company, that would be an extremely odd decision. It reminds me most of all of the genesis of the PlayStation, which was originally going to be a disc add-on for the Nintendo SNES. And then that whole partnership fell apart. And I kind of think Oculus is in that weird position right now where deals being made before the Facebook buyout or shortly after, it was thinking of itself as, you know, we'll be the plucky partner to a major player. And then Facebook came in and were like, no. No, you're going to be the major player. And I think Oculus, from what I get from the outside, they're still having a bit of trouble coming round to that. They don't know in 10 years whether they'll be a hardware manufacturer selling, you know, the competitor to the PlayStation 5, or they could be the next app store. They could be taking a cut on sales of virtual reality games built using the Oculus API with commodity hardware and commodity software and, you know, everything outsourced, but they got there first, so they built the platform that everyone builds on.
Okay, so yeah, a lot going on. The outcome remains to be seen. How many stars do we feel about this development? Wow, a lot of disagreements around the table. Got zero stars from Sam, one from Lena.
Despite everything, the dork factor is just too big.
So that's why you're holding two. Yeah, honestly, I'm going to hold up one star. Keith has four, of course, because he loves video games so much.
The difference between the theory and the practice, and once you've had a go on this headset, it's so freaking cool. It's also really primitive.
It's a proof of concept. I'm not convinced yet of the exciting long-term applications.
Can I just say, one of my highlights of this year was we did a Guardian open house event early on in the summer, and I got Alan Rusbridger to try a virtual reality space shoot 'em up, and that was one of my great moments. He really liked it.
So, okay, I suppose we have to talk about Gamergate.
Gamergate?
Yeah, it's just this thing. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I don't know. Explain it to me as if I don't know anything about it.
Oh, no. Do I have to? So, full disclosure, I was personally affected by the issue, being, like Keith, a games journalist. So, this year, a bunch of passionate video game fans reacted negatively to what they perceived as the infringement of women and progressive values on their space. But actually, it's about ethics and games journalism. Under the pretense of doing an interrogation of the ethics of the press, they set out to try to harass and assault and remove women from positions of influence in game development and in games journalism. Because for them, the only way that a woman's game could become popular, or that a non-conventional, diverse game could be widely lauded by the press, there would have had to have been a conspiracy. They fully believed an ethical breach had taken place on the part of the press because of the fact their industry is changing. That's really the short of it. There were a number of ugly episodes, and it got to comical levels of detail where they are mining into academic work groups looking for evidence of collusion that is somehow negatively influencing the games industry, which is, of course, absurd. But, you know, we've tried to sort of let them talk to themselves, and we've tried to let it die down. And I think it is finally dying down. But unfortunately, it's done a great deal of harm in terms of setting back the perception of the video gaming audience, which I know, Keith, in our work, we try a lot to evangelize for the potential in games and to show that there are many things that it can mean to be a video game player. And now here come these guys again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's been you know, kind of heartbreaking in a way, because I have spent the last kind of 15 years of my career telling everyone that video games are worth playing, and that this is a valid, exciting culture full of really engaged people. And then suddenly I'm on the baddie side. I'm one of the colluding
people. Were targeted as well, basically. And anyone who writes prominently about video games was targeted at some point by high school level analysis of their work, with red lines drawn through the names that you wrote about in case you know them in real life. Because, God forbid you should ever professionally network.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I think, fundamentally at the bottom of Gamergate, whatever, there's lots of people within Gamergate who I think honestly do see it as something about ethics and game journalism, although it confuses me because they hate all the sites that they see as ethically corrupt. You just think, okay, just don't go to those sites.
The interesting lessons that I'm going to take away, and that I think news organizations may want to take away from this, is that it was about something much bigger than video games. These are silencing tactics that are going to be used in all kinds of situations where politics are in conflict. This is astroturfing. This is taking a segment of the truth and spreading it around like a napalm blast, not caring where it hits. These are basically conservative harassment tactics that I think we're going to see again in other contexts. And I think most news organizations over the last decade were really excited about the opportunity to have comment sections and engage with the readers and be open to feedback. And the dialogue is a two-way street. And I think now we're seeing that there can be a downside of that, and thinking about how companies can protect their writers from harm that their audience can cause. Lena?
I totally agree with that, because we obviously work with comment sections all the time on the community team. And actually, the thing that concerned me most about Gamergate is that actually it meant that a lot of writers didn't want to go below the line anymore. They didn't want to engage with their readers. And we know from our work day in, day out, that the best way to improve a comment thread is if the writer goes in. Unfortunately, in some cases, that's just not possible. And it's partly due to tactics like this.
We've all been through a lot this year. Alex, I'm sorry, you were waiting to add something.
Yeah, well, no, I actually, you preempted me. I think if we're doing this as, a looking back on 2014, then Gamergate as a whole, it's starting to become clearer and clearer that it does fit in this broader pattern of, this is how a certain strand of libertarian conservative politics organizes online. I think the left had sort of hashtag activism as their thing in 2014, and this is how that libertarian right has caught on to the same thing. We've seen it in Gamergate, but there have already been echoes of it before. The comics industry has its own little kerfuffles like this all the time, and it's now increasingly how wider politics works. It's the same deal. It's screen capped conversations. It's taking words out of context. It's someone who has the time to read 40,000 tweets but not one book. It's this sort of thing. You'll never see a Gamergater quote underlining passages from someone's work where they explain at length what they think, but you will always see them digging up the tweet from 4 years back, where they offhandedly respond to a friend. And I think that's how these culture wars are going to carry on.
So based on the degree of harm that Gamergate did to people working in the industry, both men and women, and the way that it set back the perception of people who play video games, how many stars do we want to give Gamergate?
Well,
Keith put his hands under the desk.
I don't want to give it any stars, to be honest. In terms of harm,
I'm holding up a zero.
As a cultural incident, and being significant in that, as you say, Lee, this is going to reemerge time and time again, I think it was nowhere near as significant as Gamergaters would like it to be, but I do think it, unfortunately, has probably set a precedent for how these kind of campaigns are going to run. So it's probably two.
Negative 500 stars from me. I have not had a great year. But it's all better now.
That's in no way saying that it is a credible thing. It's just talking about its impact.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
So I think moment number four has Sam written all over it. I see the word wearables in my mind right now. In September of this year, Apple announced its Apple Watch, following Google's Android Wear deluge and Glass finally rolling out to the UK. How about Sam? What do we know about Apple's long-awaited watch?
So it's not called the iWatch.
And
believe it or not, Tim Cook even called it the iWatch by mistake once, so it was obviously called the iWatch up until a point. Anyway, Apple rolled this thing out. All it actually really did was roll out the idea of the Apple Watch, because it's not going to be available until spring 2015. So, and the reason they've done that is because when you bring out a brand new product line, it has to go through certain checks for regulatory bodies. And so at the point at which you're doing that, the documents then become publicly available. So to control the moment, you pre-announce it and then eventually get it through all the checks and then make it ready. So anyway, the Apple Watch is, well, it's a smartwatch from Apple. You know, it's pretty obvious. but it wasn't the first this year, and it won't be the last next year. So before the Apple Watch was announced, you had a deluge of Android Wear devices.
And how do those compare, the Apple Watch versus the Android Wear stuff?
Pretty similar, if I'm honest. And even before that, you had the Pebble. So, I mean, smartwatches have been a thing for a year or so now, but they're now starting to gain momentum. And, you know, Apple's launching, as it always does, kind of escalates things. It brings it more into the public eye, and so smartwatches are suddenly a thing. I mean, hell, I've been wearing an Android Wear watch for the best part of 4 months, five
months. So I know what side you're on.
I'm agnostic. You know, whatever's good, I use. So but as soon as Apple launched this thing, everybody started asking me, is that an Apple Watch? It's like, no. But so it has to be.
Even Apple launching a product does something for the brand awareness of all devices of that make.
Absolutely. It's had a knock-on effect. And you know, it is good that they've entered the market, because it will accelerate development of smartwatches and the software on it. And you see, one of the things that Apple's really good at is it makes a good piece of hardware to start with, but it also has a massive developer community, and it has the draw to get the good developers doing it. Like, you know, you launch a new product, nobody's got one. So what's the attraction for developers? Well, the attraction for developers for Apple is that they know that Apple's going to sell an absolute hatful of these things. Even if all it did was sell the time, the first generation is going to sell off the charts. You know, but the second generation might not, because by the time that rolls around, you have to prove that it's actually useful and does something.
Can I add a note of skepticism here? It's just that we've obviously seen Google Glass, which slightly began its decline towards disappearing into the great technology armpit of wherever. And watches are only one form factor of the whole wearable technology trend, if you like. And I don't think we found the convincing form factor yet. I think glass, for almost everybody, is too invasive. You saw people being mugged and sort of abused in bars and being called glass holes for having these rather invasive sort of glasses.
Tumblers
in public
full of
places.
White guys wearing Google Glass.
Exactly. There are more specific fitness trackers that you can wear on certain parts of your body. So if you're into tennis, you can put them on your racket, or put them on your arm or whatever. And then there's watches, which are a very existing kind of form factor. And so they don't really feel that new in a way. And most smartwatches, because they pair with your phone, just mean you have to carry another thing. So I'm not really convinced by any of them yet.
I think the big question for the Apple Watch and for this industry in general is going to be whether the Apple Watch is, to use blunt analogies, the Apple TV or the iPad. Those were both products which entered a market which definitely already existed. Unlike the iPhone, they were not revolutionary. Even the iPad was very clearly something that anyone could have drawn if they'd spent 5 minutes and gone, oh yeah, it will look like this. But whereas the iPad came and just seemed to catch people's imagination in a way which devices before that hadn't, and catalyzed a whole new industry, the Apple TV came and didn't. I do think the Apple TV is an odd situation. If it had sold in iPad numbers, the third generation Apple TV would be an amazing product, but it didn't, and so that whole segment just never took off. The Apple Watch, I don't know whether it will be that. Sam's experience wandering around wearing an Android watch shows that there are at least some people who are really excited about it.
Or at least curious
about it. But there's just a lot more people, I think, out there who right now, having not seen these in action, go, eh.
It's the killer app. It's the killer app. And there is no killer app for a smartwatch yet.
Star rating?
Yeah. How do we feel about the watches?
2.
Well, we've had very low ratings. We have 5 stars from Sam, 4 from her.
I'm really not that excited about smartwatches. Sorry.
1 from me. I'm curious to see what will happen, but I don't want to wear a watch.
No, I don't. I've got it on my phone.
I've got it on my phone.
Will you be able to do video calls? Because to me, that would be exciting. Just because I grew up watching Star Trek.
You can do it on your phone.
How many technologies are being driven by men who want to act out Star Trek versus practical applications?
Yeah, we wouldn't have the iPad without Star Trek.
Can we have a cracker break? I think I need a joke.
Yeah.
Okay, right, Lee.
It didn't bang.
I just won a shoehorn. Woo! I've never had a shoehorn.
You
did
it. Here. There we go. Hey! Yay!
How do you stop a skunk smelling? Hold its nose.
Oh, clever.
Wow.
1 out of 5. Wow. Yeah. Next.
So, Alex, you on the Apple front are most excited about Apple Pay and various payment systems. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I file Apple Pay right alongside where I look at Apple Watch, right alongside where I look at Apple's entry into almost every market. It's not revolutionary. It's not even really, if we're going to be, you know, a stickler for it, new. But what it is it's Apple doing it. And that means 2 things. Firstly, it means that not the press get interested and the public get interested. People do not care about mobile payments, but Apple is so good at branding and marketing that they do care about Apple Pay. If you tell someone...
Because it has the word Apple on it?
Because it has the word Apple on it, but also just because people have a certain element of trust in Apple. If you tell someone, oh, you can pay with your Samsung phone now, they're going to go, is it going to be a hassle? Is it going to work? Is it going to be taken anywhere? You tell someone that they can pay with Apple Pay and by and large, the response is, ooh, cool, where? And just pushing over that hurdle, I think, could be enough that Apple Pay becomes the thing that completely rejuvenates or completely changes how we spend our money next year.
There's just a little bit more faith in the company's ability to execute.
Right, there's faith in the company's ability to execute. That's exactly it. And the more important thing is, just as the iPad introduced tablets that actually worked and got people using that form factor, just as the Apple Watch could make smartwatches go from something which is technically on the shelves now to something which people are actually excited about, Apple Pay could get people actually using in large numbers their mobile phones to make payments in the real world and online. And that is really exciting because that's the catalyst you need to get things like Bitcoin working at one end of the spectrum, to get things like Square, Jack Dorsey's startup, to take off at the other end of the spectrum. You just need people to get over that initial hurdle. And I think Apple is the right company to do that.
Sam?
I mean, Apple has a massive advantage here because it has an absolute buttload of credit cards on file already. It's one of those things where, you know, they're in the right position to do this and they have the will to force it through. And that's one of the things, you know, one manufacturer to have the will to force this through is what's required. You know, Google's tried and failed, but it didn't have the manufacturing nous to get this thing into the public.
Elena?
I don't know. There's got to be something a little bit extra that's going to make me have faith in them as much as I like Apple.
A free kitten?
Yes, a free kitten would be great. Yeah. Thank you.
It's massively overlooked as an instigator of change.
So how excited are we? How many stars of excitement do we feel about Apple Pay?
I think 3.
Oh, I'm 3, 2, Alex, five. Alex is 5. Wow. I've got 3 as well. 2, oh, only 1 from Sam.
Wow.
Because you can't do it with your watch.
But you can already do it on Android.
PayPal.
Yeah. Moving on to our sixth moment. So this year, when we're talking about social media, it seems like the photo has won out over the text. Elena, Instagram has outgrown Twitter this year.
Yeah, it outgrew Twitter. Well, it announced that it had outgrown Twitter a couple of weeks ago. It's now got 80 million users, 4 billion images shared since its launch in 2010. So it's done pretty well for itself. I do think that it has the advantage over Twitter because images just seem to be so much more exciting for users. But also, you can't get away from the fact that people are going to be far more interested in seeing pictures from celebrities on Instagram than they are going to be seeing their tweets. Also, it's like candy for some media organisations. They see, oh my God, Khloe Kardashian posted this Facebook, no, not Facebook, Instagram pic. This is amazing. And then it's just a wealth of information about and pictures of celebrities that we wouldn't have had before.
Even when I use Twitter now, I notice that there are more frequently images embedded in tweets. I think users are acclimatized to browsing through snippets of text with images interspersed where they, you know, might not have been before.
I mean, the thing I find most interesting about the Instagram overtaking Twitter is it shows that Facebook's second wave of company strategy is really working. Its first wave was Facebook everywhere, and it kind of has achieved that. Facebook is one of those companies where its growth is now limited by the population of the earth, or at the very least the internet access, the population of the earth which has access to the internet, which is part of the reason why Mark Zuckerberg is spearheading an initiative to get internet access more widely available. But what that meant is that Facebook's first tier of fears wasn't any more that someone else would come along and replace Facebook. That's not really possible. It was that it would die through a thousand cuts, that what people use Facebook for would gradually be sliced off, that some new events app would take the events away, that a good messaging app would take messaging away, and that photos, which still really are the core of Facebook, could be taken away by another app. And that was Instagram. That was what Instagram looked like when Facebook acquired it. It looked like it could be the thing, which means that we just share fewer and fewer photos on Facebook. Now it's Facebook. Facebook doesn't care.
Importantly, Instagram has integration. You just tick a box or two and you can share the photo to several locations at once. So it's already sort of a natural fit. I sort of try to raise my Instagram followers by Instagramming to Twitter more often.
I'm not going to lie though. I said this in a previous podcast and I'll say it again. Facebook's lack of creativity has completely frustrated me. Okay, yes, all this works.
Bring back
for them
MySpace.
Very well. Yeah, no, you thank you. We don't need that back.
Elena misses her Zanga.
I don't miss any of it. I just find it really frustrating that instead of actually coming up with their own ideas, they used to be the young kids on the block who had all these new things that they were doing. Instead of doing that, they just think, okay, who's doing something really cool that could threaten us? Let's buy them. I'm just
well,
bored of it.
Well, that's big business for you.
I know
that's
it's a big
work.
Business. I know it's how it works. But I am bored of it. I demand it changes now.
Right, but let's change that then.
But I did read an article the other day where there was a suggestion that Twitter should be worried because Instagram is becoming quite popular with journalists. Everyone knows that Twitter is journalists' favourite social network because it's really easy to source snippets of news and to source stories from it. With Instagram, you not only get those stories, you also get the pictures alongside it. I'm not wholly convinced by that because Instagram is very, very serious about keeping it mobile only. And it's really hard to like search stuff on desktop and to have a look for things around in the same way as you can with Twitter. So I don't know if it's that much of a threat in that sense.
Keith.
I just want to say one last thing about Instagram is that what's interesting to me is it's part of this kind of whole imagification of social sharing.
Trademark.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe I could use that. I'll do a TED talk. But it's this idea that the generation Z or Z or whoever you want to pronounce it aren't kind of interested so much in sharing their lives through words. It's sharing through images. And if you look at like the rise of YouTube in kind of journalism, but also kind of the sort of diaries that people are putting on YouTube now, nothing is shared through words. It's all through images. And Instagram is like a massive part of that whole cultural shift from sharing through narratives which are written to narratives which are shown. It's kind of the sort of narcissism of it is quite interesting.
Yeah, it
pictures
is interesting.
Are just really captivating. That's what it boils
words
down to.
Words used to be captivating.
I think they still can be. See, I think that if you look at BuzzFeed, for example, where they're like, oh, lists, pictures, things like this, look at their long reads. Look how they merge pictures with text and see how well it works. That's what I think is sort of the next thing, is when maybe more for publishers rather than social media people just generally. Mm. Merging those two to create, you know, some really, really well-told stories.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, though, like looking at the... obviously, The Onion launched Clickhole this year, and I do wonder whether... is that to parody BuzzFeed, or is it to capture the BuzzFeed audience? Yes.
It's both at the same time.
You can't parody BuzzFeed. They parody themselves all the time, so I just don't really think the Clickhole works in that sense.
Well, how many stars of excitement do we feel about the growth of Instagram?
And imageification.
I'm going to say four because it makes my job really easy.
I'll say three.
Two and a half.
Oh, and a big zero from Sam. He's the tough one here at the table.
And Sammy clearly don't work within community.
This might be the highest star ranked event so far on our Christmas list.
And I didn't even think this was that big a story when Newsbeat were making a big fuss about it.
Well, it looks like we owe you a round so far. You're winning.
Woo!
This year we saw an explosion in hashtag activism, which means people using hashtags to further a cause. And to some extent, this isn't anything new. You know, Twitter and the hashtag have been sort of married since the birth of the platform. But this year it really exploded with Bring Back Our Girls hashtag. It was a global reaction to the kidnapping of some 250 schoolgirls in Nigeria. More than 1 million people, including Nobel Prize winner Malala Yousafzai and First Lady Michelle Obama, got involved. Campaigns have almost automatically had a hashtag for a while now, but it feels like 2014 really brought this to the forefront. The question is, does it work? Yeah, it's good for raising awareness of things, but does it count as activism? Is it sort of a tidy bite that people can take out of their day that fulfills their mental activism checkmark without actually creating an impact? What do you think?
There's definitely a sense of that. I mean, you know, if this replaces people needing to do something more substantial, then that's... it's a shame. I mean, it's good to get a measure of things, but it's almost too easy to be an armchair activist now and actually just going on to 38 degrees or just tweeting something. What does that achieve? There's some level of impact. You perhaps are hoping that the media is going to pick up on the story, that there will be momentum, that it's a kind of way of doing a census, if you like, of how much the public values and supports a certain issue. But what is really, really going to push for action? There are democratic levers in place, such as writing to your MP, where they have an obligation to reply to you on a certain issue. And it kind of falls down on that. If it just is kind of an empty shout into the internet and doesn't go anywhere, then that's a shame.
It's telling that, I mean, Bring Back Our Girls was by one measure the most successful piece of hashtag activism of the year. It got Michelle Obama involved, it got millions of people. By another measure, of course, it absolutely failed because those girls are still held hostage by Boko Haram.
And Nigeria has been dealing with Boko Haram for years. As the writer Teju Cole says, does a, quote, wave of global sentimentality help?
Right. I think what we have seen this year is we've seen examples of where hashtag activism has actually worked, done something beyond this sort of mealy-mouthed concept of raising awareness. And those are the times when the mere act of having a conversation about a topic is activism. I think that for me, the most important example of hashtag activism this year were the Why I Stayed and Why I Left hashtags, which were both about women's reactions to domestic violence brought about by an NFL player's evidence that an NFL player hit his wife. People started discussing their own experiences being in abusive relationships. It's a topic which does not get spoken about, and when it does get spoken about, one voice that is rarely heard is that of the woman who experienced domestic abuse and stayed in a relationship. It's something that we as a culture don't like to suggest exists because we like to pretend that it's a very easy thing. People know if they're being abused and they're trying to get out, and that's all great.
And we have this platform where we can very quickly register judgment on situations, but we don't often have the opportunity to connect with people who have been in those situations. Lena, you had something to add.
Well, I feel like there's a big difference between what Alex describes and Bring Back Our Girls. As well-meaning as it was, like we've said, it didn't really do much.
It didn't bring the girls back.
No, it absolutely didn't.
And how many people do you think participated in the hashtag who've completely disinvested from the issue since then?
Absolutely, and that happens quite a lot. And it's frustrating to see when you have members of parliament, for example, or some people with real political influence taking part in hashtag activism, because it's like you actually have the power to be able to do something, anything.
Right.
Why are you just getting involved on a hashtag?
We're hashtagging because we're not politicians and we can't actually change laws.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You can't do that. I mean, one that frustrated me this year was Cameron Must Go. It was a feat that they had it trending for quite a while. And it was a huge backlash against the Tory-led government and David Cameron. And yeah, okay, it was great. It trended for ages, but it was filled with misinformation. It was trying to bring attention to really important issues about cuts in the UK, yet also adding on top of that really ridiculous tweets about how much the hashtag was worth. I was like, this is ludicrous. And then they were complaining that the BBC wasn't covering it because apparently a hashtag trending means that it's news. That's not the case. It was just really frustrating to see this, where it's like, yes, absolutely, if we get Cameron Must Go trending for however much time, David Cameron will resign. Well, he hasn't. So, yeah.
Well, it looks like they didn't spend their time well. Keith, what did you want to say?
I just want to say what I'm interested in with hashtag Activision is the way that
did you just say hashtag Activision?
Activision.
I think you did.
Don't interest me about Activision. Yeah. Bringing it back to games for a minute.
Speaking about Destiny.
What interests me is the way that people have fitted it into their lives. Like, what one of the reasons that mobile gaming or social gaming has become part of people's lives is that it's based around this idea of appointment gaming. So people have these parts of their day, so they're sort of playing Candy Crush Saga for half an hour, doing a few pitches on Facebook, and then going, oh, I engaged in some hashtag activism.
So are you saying that basically on their commutes, when they're crushed and they're angry, what they're doing is, instead of shouting at the person opposite, they're going onto the internet and getting activism?
Yeah. Or playing Candy Crush. I honestly think there's a psychological space in which those things are identical these days because of
It's frustrating because I see so much value in people sharing their stories under a hashtag. Like, there's so much value in that, because it's people actually saying, do you know what, this is something I want to talk about. People talking about their personal experiences. But just sharing a hashtag being like, yes, this is going to make a difference. I have nothing to do with this issue, but if I put the hashtag, then I definitely will. That's different to me, anyway.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. I mean, I know that everyone says awareness is only part of the work of activism, but diminishing awareness, awareness is still important, and that these conversations can take place, and that through these trending hashtags, we learn about other people's experiences that we might not have been exposed to. We have an opportunity to listen to other people's conversations when they may come from a different walk of life than us, and that creates empathy from us toward people that we may have never met. So I think, as an empathy awareness tool, I think I wouldn't underrate the hashtag, but I do think it's important that, as everyone here says, we remember it's not all the work of activism and that it doesn't actually change the world.
Keith, can you do that?
Sorry, I've got a crack here now.
How many stars?
Oh, star rating.
I don't know, two stars.
Zero stars for the bad hashtag activism, and
five stars for the good.
It's two things smushed under one name.
Absolutely.
This year will be remembered for the launch of the iPhone 6, but it's the 6 Plus that's really a marker in tech this year. Apple's iPhone 6 Plus is a tacit acceptance that the phablet is a real contender for a global phone format, both here in the UK and in the US and Asian markets. Sam, you've pointed this out. Will you tell us more?
Yeah, so I think we better start with the definition of the phablet. It kind of started off as any phone with a screen that was bigger than 5 inches. But, well, that's kind of expanded because almost every flagship phone is bigger than 5 inches now. So the definition is stretched a little bit. So it's basically, phablet is half phone, half tablet. So it's any large screen phone, really. And see, for the 6 Plus, for instance, it has a screen is 5.5 inches. Now, to put it in perspective, Apple's previous maximum screen size was 4 inches. So this is a beast compared to the original iPhones. You know. And the iPhone 6 itself, not the Plus, is only 4.7 inches. So
that's still too big for me to text one-handed.
Yeah, I mean,
my hands are too tiny.
See, this brings into the... So it wasn't only Apple that launched a phablet this year. Google also launched its own phablet, the Nexus 6. And the two together mark the kind of like, this is the year of the phablet, at the point at which both of the main powerhouses in mobile computing launch phablets, then you know it's really come to roost.
I think you have to sort of point out why they've been so popular and why there's been a real growth of interest in these. And it's because of changing consumer behaviour. I mean, they're called smartphones, but there are almost every day, actually, I will go through without making a phone call. And I use it far more for other things because I have a long train journey every day. I'm using it more for reading stuff and for writing emails. So I switched to a larger phone this year, and within half an hour, sort of fiddling between the two devices while I upgraded, and then went back to the older, smaller phone and went, oh my God, I can't believe I ever used a screen this small. So you adjust so quickly. And the small hands thing, it's just not really an issue.
So I'm a phablet truther.
I accept. What does that even mean?
What it means is I fully accept that there are some people, Jemima included, who have taken a look at a normal sized phone and a phablet and genuinely gone, yep, you know what, this is the phone I want. I also think that a lot of the demand for larger screen phones is an artifact of the fact that most manufacturers have to make their highest end phone large to fit everything in. There are very, very few companies which make spec identical large phone and normal size phone, which means that there is almost by definition going to be a portion of phablet buyers who would rather get the same specs in a normal sized phone and are dealing with a phablet. They're buying it despite its size, not because of it. I know, for instance, people who have the 6 Plus because of the camera have done that, and people who have the 6 Plus because of the battery life have done that.
I agree with you in some respects.
Angry about phablets.
Well, it used to be definitely the case, especially when 4G first came in. When 4G came in, the chipsets were really power hungry. So the only way you could make a phone that lasted more than 10 seconds was to put a massive battery in it, which meant that the phones had to be bigger. Now, the reason we've kind of set a course, and we can't really get away from it. The reason all the large phones are the top spec'd ones is because if you put top spec in a smaller phone, nobody buys it.
But this is the first time Apple has the iPhone 6, that's the exact opposite of the actual sales patterns. The iPhone 6 has outsold the 6 Plus 4-1. I genuinely think this proves that Bush did 9/11. I mean that the demand for phablets is entirely artificial.
Well, I have a sure to be unpopular theory, and it makes me think of when Nintendo released a slightly larger version of its clamshell DS portable gaming system. And one of the rationales it used was, well, we want kids to play with their grandparents, and grandparents need a bigger screen. I wonder, could the trend toward a bigger screen be driven by the fact that we, this first generation of smartphone users, are getting older?
Yeah, I mean,
you winced.
Maybe. Actually,
I mean, are we going to need them as we get older?
Well, at the moment, the text just gets smaller on the larger screen.
Does
so,
it?
Well, you know, it's proportionally stretched. You get more real estate. I mean, it might be a case where all our eyes are going to go, and yes, we are going to need, but hopefully by that stage, aren't we going to have it beamed directly into our eyeballs?
So, the internet in our brains.
Yeah, we just think. And
it's exactly what's going to happen, by the way.
What does this mean for the iPad mini?
It's dead. Well, I mean, it's not dead, but it's kind of, it's being chipped away at. There's no real point.
What's the difference in size, Sam, just to put it in context?
So an iPad mini has a screen that is 7.9 inches. Now, that is actually quite a big difference between the 5.5-inch iPhone 6 Plus and the iPad mini. But in real terms, it kind of erodes the appeal of the iPad mini, because when you had a tiny phone, you could carry this kind of semi-portable tablet.
It's true. I don't use a tablet anymore. I just go straight between my desktop or my laptop computer and my phone.
I did an experiment. I was wondering how big phablets could possibly get, and my wife has got an iPad mini, so I was pretending to use it as a phone. It doesn't work.
You see, the thing is,
I went through a number of exercises and they failed all of them.
Many companies are very good at maximizing screen space to device size. Apple is not one of them. I mean, for instance, the iPhone 6 Plus has a 5.5-inch screen. It's practically the same as phones that have 6-inch screens. So there's quite a lot of loss there. You see, my issue is never with the screen size. I don't think phablets are great for me. Phablets are an artifact. I want the most powerful phone, so I buy the most powerful phone, or I use the most up-to-date one.
And
But, you know, I mean, I'm not a typical user. I do value one-handed use because I'm normally clinging to some sort of tube pole as I'm being rammed through the commute in and out of London. But, you know, so not being in fear of dropping the thing is one of my primary concerns.
What if you could wear it, though, Sam? If you could wear it. If you could have
I tried it.
Gaffer tape.
Oh, well, you know, I mean...
Around your neck like a hype man.
Yeah. I wore Google Glass for a week and, you know...
Man, he knows what time it is.
Yeah. What about, like, two selfie poles around your neck?
You disgust me. I mean, oh, my God.
Star rating?
Yeah, star rating for the phablets.
I think three.
Two from me.
Yeah. No, Jemima, no, two. Not three. Zero.
Oh.
Four from me.
Well, that's actually a respectable score from this team. It's been a hard, each story has been a pretty hard sell. So now onto drones. So this is the year that drones went from being a sort of niche or geek occupation into mainstream awareness. So we've had Dronestagram, where you can go and see drone camera footage. Some of it's artistic, some of it's voyeuristic, some of it is military. Aviation regulators have been grappling with what drone pilots should and shouldn't be allowed to do. And how many celebrity weddings were plagued by drones? Let's talk about drones. Who has drone feelings?
they're a really, really fun toy.
You have one?
I mean, this is the problem. They're also a really, really expensive toy. They are so much fun to play with. Like, I actually have quite a lot of time for technology which gets through its awkward learning stage by just being fun. And that's quite clearly what drones are right now, at least in the consumer sector. Right now, there is this technology which, to make it actually usable, costs... Well, the price for good usable drones is down to about £480. That is an expensive outlay. But the technology is now simple enough and well-tested enough that you can make a really, really fun toy and sell it for £80, usable with anyone who has a smartphone or a tablet.
A Sharper Image catalogue.
Right.
Well, this is yet another technology that started in the military space. And drones, say, even 2 years ago, were synonymous in the mainstream public mind with military bombs over the Middle East and Afghanistan and murder future. Yeah, or a dark surveillance future. But small, not domestic exactly, but small consumer drones mean that for those people who are really interested enough to spend several thousand pounds on that toy, they have been doing kind of creative arty projects on Dronestagram. As you mentioned, there was a really beautiful kind of very artistic video of people swimming in the sea off Brighton Beach, and the camera was just on the drone flying around them in circles, but beautifully edited, and it's something quite captivating about it. It is quite liberating, and from a creative point of view, it's kind of a new medium, but it has thrown up these very practical logistical questions. So in London, you're not allowed to fly a drone within, I think it's
50 meters.
Yeah, 50 yeah. meters of buildings, and then I think in the countryside you've got a bit more leniency. But we should expect to see the regulators clamping down on drones a bit more, because especially those with cameras, there are obviously enormous privacy implications, because you could fly them over anybody's house and get footage of them. So we might see celebrities. I don't think Madonna lives in this country anymore, but she was just the kind of person who would say, no, I don't want your drone flying over my Scottish, so she might go to a judge and issue an injunction. Anyway, there's a whole raft of stories. I think journalistically and creatively, they're really interesting, and we'll be seeing lots more of them.
And even if I didn't live in the city, I'd feel a bit strange knowing that my neighbour had purchased a drone. I would keep my blinds closed.
If it's your neighbour, you can just put a camera up. They don't need a drone.
I know, but there's a little bit of an extra conceptual thing there.
They make quite a lot of noise, though.
Do they?
Yeah. I mean...
A thousand angry bees.
These are effectively stabilised helicopters. They're not going to be... I mean, you're going to hear this thing coming, unless you have the best double glazing in the world ever.
If we're doing 2014 trends, I mean, one trend throughout the year that has really annoyed me is drone deliveries.
Definitely.
It started, didn't it, in the tail end of 2013 when Amazon ran its PR stunt
that
about
was just a hoax.
Automatic. Well, I mean, it wasn't a hoax.
It felt like a hoax.
I don't doubt that Amazon has at least one drone capable of picking a package up and putting it somewhere. But it's just become this trend throughout the year. Almost every company that would be working in that space has shown some fancily produced video of drones carrying a package from A to B. And it's such an overhyped, nonsensical thing. Drones, you need to fly them manually. What you're talking about is essentially a very, very, very expensive bike courier. You need a one-to-one thing. It just doesn't work.
The outrage is palpable. Elena, what do you think?
You know, the one that annoyed me was the restaurant that attached some mistletoe to some drones. Was it TGI Fridays? Yeah, and then they were flying this drone around and then getting couples to snog each
other.
Wasn't
somebody injured by this?
Someone was injured. A journalist was injured.
Then they chopped someone's nose off.
Well, I don't think it chopped it off.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it chopped it off. It definitely cut it.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, like, it's just a recipe for
disaster. How did you hurt your face? Oh, the TGI Friday's mistletoe drone.
I know, it's just so
bad. I want to see the incident report on that.
There's a lot of potential here, and it has to get over the stigma, you're right. But there's also a safety factor. I mean, it's not just privacy. We've had near misses with airplanes. I mean, there was one recently in the last week or so at one of the UK's biggest airports. And, you know, a drone smashing in and mashing up an engine... That's really bad news.
There was also a guy who was prosecuted because his drone, he lost control of his drone, because if they obviously go out of flight range, they can't be controlled and they just drop out of the sky. And he happened to be doing it near a nuclear facility, which didn't go down that well.
Richard LaMartian, who's an amazing game designer who now teaches game design at University of Southern California, did a great speech this year talk about the future of video games. And he said that one of the possible futures of video games was the hybridization of games with drones. And I think that's really interesting.
Parrots AR drones.
As
long as you have enough rich friends with a lot of them, you can play this kind of drone warfare where the camera is used to detect shots and things like that, and it's all done through
tablets.
I have
so many rich friends, I could definitely do that.
We really need a new name for the ones that aren't killing people, because drone warfare is a thing.
Yeah, this is such a shame.
Like bees and killer bees, maybe we'll have drones and killer drones. So our final moment of this year's list is the acquisition of Minecraft creator Mojang by Microsoft. Everybody knows what Minecraft is. If you've got kids, chances are they or their schoolmates are interested in Minecraft. It's a creative block-building game where you sort of play and build everything you want. And gosh, I was in the airport in Kuala Lumpur, and there was a selection of Minecraft adventure books for young adults about kids who go in the Minecraft world and solve mysteries. Like, you wouldn't think that there would be a story to tell about this collaborative building game, but Minecraft is utterly huge. It's probably the most popular video game in the world right now, and has been for a few years. Microsoft bought Minecraft creator Mojang for $2.5 billion. This is a massive acquisition. Keith, you want to tell us why?
Why did they do it? Well, I mean, obviously it's massively popular. It's enormous, with like 35 million people have downloaded and bought the game. It's a cultural phenomenon. I think for Microsoft, not only is it a great kind of games platform to own, because it is essentially a platform, they can just keep selling skins and items for it. But it's also a way of getting younger people, because it's massively popular with like 6 to 12 year olds. These are people that don't really know who Microsoft is. They know Apple.
So they're going to try to make all these kids buy Windows phones now.
Well, I think maybe it's a way of. I mean, there were so many jokes when the purchase went through that.
I know, I was making some.
Yeah, suddenly on screen in Minecraft, you're going to get a little paperclip come up and say, "I see you're trying to build the Eiffel Tower." The argument is that it's essentially to introduce children to the idea of Microsoft as a platform holder, so that when they grow up, maybe they will buy Office instead of, I don't know, using Google Documents like everybody's sensible.
Oh, bless.
They're not really that insane.
I think they're trying
to build a new audience
It's an incredibly valuable property which has masses of growth left in it.
Microsoft used to own and manage a number of internal games developers, and now it's primarily a platform company. So I think this is the first game studio acquisition for the company in a while, if I'm not mistaken.
They've taken over, for example, one of their own studios, 343 Industries, now runs the Halo franchise since Bungie moved to Destiny, which is made by Activision.
Which I've
accidentally, somehow that has...
But I
think so. I mean, they have their own internal studios working on Xbox One games. But, you know, some of their internal licenses, they've got massive successes like Forza, but, you know, things like Lionhead and Fable has got a bit lost. Fable Legends is coming out next year. But I think Minecraft is a kind of a definite return on investment, I think, for them. They literally, I don't believe they could mess this up.
Is there some wood in the room for us to touch? Yeah.
But there's been a lot of worries about what they'll do. And I think they have said what Facebook said about Oculus Rift, is that we're just going to leave it be and let Mojang do what they're good at, and we'll just suck in the cash. Thanks very much.
That's famously hands-off Microsoft. Does anyone else have any thoughts on the Minecraft acquisition?
I should probably play Minecraft someday, shouldn't I?
Yeah, me too. I've never played it either.
Oh my God, I'm so glad I'm not the only one.
There's such a generation gap opening up as well. It's like in the vocabulary of every child I've ever met these days, and not many adults play it that I know of.
I think, you know, Minecraft is kind of a form of communication now for young people. It's like it's a way of expressing themselves creatively and socially. It's like it's a platform for so many different things. So, but I'm a massive advocate of this game because you've built
some things with your family, right?
Oh yeah, loads and loads and loads. My sons play it a lot, and you know I keep talking about this, but my oldest son is on the autism spectrum, and Minecraft for him has been like massively important. Like he has come on in so many ways because it's allowed him to express himself, and it puts him in a position where he understands Minecraft really well. So when friends come around who are better than him at almost everything else, he's the one that can tell them how to build worlds. He really understands this. So, you know, I am not an objective voice on Minecraft because I think it's a wonderful, beautiful thing, and I cannot thank them enough for making it. But yeah, for my son and for lots of other children, it's a method of communication that's why it's so important, and that's why Microsoft bought it.
That's really interesting.
What do you think is next for Minecraft? That's what I've always wondered. Is it something that's just going to run and run like World of Warcraft, or is it something that's going to evolve into something else?
I think so. I think it's very much that it's that model, because it's interesting in that people that have latched onto it are kind of traditional in what can be done with it. I think in some ways what has happened so far is that the world has got bigger, and and there's been elements and skins that have been added to it, and there's so much in it now that actually users themselves can customize. There's almost no point for like a Minecraft 2. You know, Minecraft is about these kind of blocky worlds. So if you decided to make another Minecraft, which was kind of, I don't know, much more higher definition, or the blocks were much smaller, then you're getting into a completely different realm of creativity and difficulty. Well, I think the beauty of it is its simplicity. It's like Lego, you know. Lego doesn't fundamentally change. They bring in pieces and take out pieces. But the bare essence of what Lego is hasn't changed for decades.
How many stars for Minecraft?
Just for like, Keith's story, well, I'm going to give it 5.
Me too, because that was
beautiful. Happy Christmas.
That was a wonderful story to finish this episode with. Well, it's been anything but a dull 2014, and 2015 is shaping up to be another big year in tech and digital. Of course, the Guardian Tech team will be along for the ride. I hope you'll join us all throughout 2015 on Tech Weekly. Huge thank you to the whole team for coming down, whether you're in the studio or not. Jemima Kish, Alex Hearn, Samuel Gibbs, Keith Stewart, Elena Cressy, Stuart Dredge, Alex Kratowski, and Hannah Jane Parkinson. From me, Lee Alexander, and our Guardian Head of Audio, and our producer, Jason Phipps, we wish you a fantastic Christmas holiday and a happy new year. See you in January. Bye.
Merry Christmas!
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.